And I can't believe. No way I can believe this. One day in 1943 at the Philadelphia Navy Yard, something happened. Suddenly, the USS Eldridge, a fully manned destroyer escort, vanished into a green fog. Within seconds, appeared in Norfolk, Virginia. I have people listening to me in Norfolk. And maybe some are going to call me. A fully manned destroyer escort vanished into a green fog. Within seconds, appeared in Norfolk, Virginia, and then reappeared in Philadelphia. Come on. That's a crock. For over 36 years, officials have denied this. Well, I'd be inclined, for the first time in my life, agree with the bureaucrats. For over 36 years, officials have denied this, have denied any experimentation to render matter invisible, have denied the reality of the Philadelphia experiment. If so, why were all the men aboard ship who survived discharged as mentally unfit? Why did a scientific researcher on the project, I was doing better, then all of a sudden I lost it. I was doing fine. As long as Joe was sitting there, it was working. Get yourself back down here, Joe. As soon as he left, it went bad. Teleport yourself down here. If it didn't happen, why were all the men aboard ship who survived discharged as mentally unfit? Huh? Why were identities hidden, documents lost? Well, and why is the amazing evidence of this book found? Now, I'm leaving some people right now. I read this book 3 times today. I'm convinced that something awful strange happened that touched the fringes of the preternatural and the supernatural and the extranatural. And it's just one more road that leads up to that brink. There are some things out there we don't fully understand. About time we take a look at them intelligently. Now, this Philadelphia experiment blows my mind. Mike, why don't you get these for the bookstore, okay? I don't know what they sell for, if they're still available. Got to be a price on this thing somewhere. They always have a price. Never sold one of these books that didn't have a price. Doesn't. Can't believe it. Doesn't have a price. Beats anything I ever saw. How can I? We'll have a price on them in the bookstore, though. This book blows me away. And I'm going to try to tie it up in a few words. You got to read it. It couldn't happen. Now, Einstein was not only working on his theory of relativity, both general and special, which totally blew our idea of reality asunder. In the mid-1920s, he was working on the unified field theory. Now, Einstein had, and maybe the relationship here, Einstein had a basic faith in God. He used to say, God did not build this universe on a roll of the dice. I may not quote him directly, but the basic premise of Einstein is that everything in this universe could be reduced to mathematical formulas. There was not chaos out there. Now, I might tell you that, and not meaning to offend, if I stay in shamanism, my own personal opinion can be separated from my respect for anyone else's position. But I'm with Einstein and I'm with the Bible. There was order before there was chaos. Jeremiah says God created, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and they were good. They became a waste and a desolation. Chaos is the conscious state to which the shaman or shaman goes, and then it's reordered. Einstein says, no, you go wherever you go in this universe, it can be reduced to order. It may look like chaos, but God didn't build it that way. So he was forever probing every dimension of reality with his mathematical formulas. Now remember this, a black hole is invisible. Captures light. One of the things that leaps out of this so-called Philadelphia experiment was the desire to bend light and create a mirage effect. And it was also part of experiments in magnetic protection to become invisible on a radar screen and as a defense and a protection against German magnetic mines. In the 1920s, the thesis of this book is, and there's evidence offered, Einstein abandoned his research in unified field theory. Now, I don't want to make this heavy. For humanitarian reasons. But the evil of Nazi Germany is what released him finally into considering the use of his genius knowledge in weapons of warfare designed to block the Nazi threat. Now, basically, the Philadelphia experiment says, in brief, let me give it to you in brief. There's a summary here that's marked by me. My mother called me today. She says, Gene, you don't believe that. Of all the things you've read, I said to Ted, he doesn't really believe that, does he? Do you know what a dielectric is? It's a material which has the unique ability of absorbing electrical energy or charge without ordinarily passing this energy on to neighboring materials. Now, one of the theories of UFOs, flying saucers, is that they've mastered this ability to absorb energy and release it at a controlled basis. To get into this heavily involves using terms, drawing upon knowledge. I think I'm getting close. They'll make it so heavy I'll lose my crowd. I don't want to do that. You're very smart, but there's a limit to what we can do in an hour. It makes me so angry to mark something in my book and not be able to find it. We're not going to be able to do this tonight because I've lost it. You believe I'll find it?
Yes, sir.
You have more faith than I got. When I go through it twice and don't find it, I begin to think I won't find it. Must not be the will of the Lord. Let's just go back to rag dolls and wonder. I was marking so many things in this book as I went through it today, and I said, now I've got to find a way to do this. In a simple way. And I'd marked so many places. I'll bet I left this one, the most important one, unmarked, so I could find it and distinguish it from the places I'd marked. Did you ever do that? You take something that you know you can't lose, and you put it by itself somewhere where you protect yourself against losing it. Then you forget where you put it. I found it. Dr. Jessup. Dear old brother Jessup. UFO expert. Scientist, archaeologist, astronomer, having written on UFOs, begins to receive a series of mysterious letters from one Carlos Miguel Allende. Later is changed to Carl M. Allen. In these letters, he is receiving reactions, apparently, from a man that resents the fact that Dr. Jessup, through his study of Einstein's theory, is trying to motivate people in lectures to get their legislators to pass a law and fund further experiments in Einstein's unified field theory. He writes the letters to discourage him, but also to tell him, hey, you're too late. It's already been done with terrible results. So don't open it up again. Jessup doesn't pay that much attention to it. He has other things in mind. He wants to go to Mexico where he's studying some strange craters and some archaeology. But the Navy, July or August 1955, in a manila envelope addressed to Admiral N. Firth, Chief, Office of Naval Research, Washington, D.C., particularly to the attention of one Darrell L. Ritter, as it was passed around, with Hattie Easter on it, came a copy of Dr. Jessup's book, The Case for the UFO. But annotated on the book that was written about UFOs by Dr. Jessup, heavy handwritten annotations and underlinings of a most perplexing sort written in at least three different colors of ink. Annotations which seemed to imply that the writer of them possessed intimate knowledge of UFOs, their means of propulsion, origin, background, and history. The book itself was well-worn. Whoever was responsible for this work had apparently spent a great amount of time doing it. They contacted Jessup. He was able to identify by keys in the annotations that were in the book that the one who sent the book with the annotations revealing so much knowledge about these things was none other than Carlos Allende, or Carl Allen. Now, the gist of Carlos Allende's posture has been stated. He claimed to be an eyewitness on a merchant marine ship while in the Navy of the events surrounding the Philadelphia experiment. He claimed to have watched the ship suddenly be enveloped with a kind of a green fog, the ship disappear, and all you could see was the markings of the hull of the ship in the water. In his letters that he had sent to Dr. Jessup, he warned against further experimentation and motivating people to go into it. The Navy contacted Jessup. Jessup becomes very involved in researching this event, dies under a very strange circumstance. Dies under a very strange circumstance. Some even have suggested he was murdered. As he, disbelieving what the fellow wrote him, continued to pursue it. The last person, or one of the last that he contacted, was none other than Dr. Valentine, the finder of those walls and roads under the water in the Bermuda Triangle, the anthropologist and diver and archaeologist that uncovered what Edgar Cayce had prophesied, remnants of Atlantis near Bimini. Now, these connections always amuse me. The co-author of this book, William H. Moore and Charles Berlitz, set out, and the analogy is like David Davison, who went to the pyramid to prove there was no prophetic message in it, ends up writing the most convincing proofs of it ever to appear in print. This guy's like Frank Morrison, who set out to take the myth out of the story of Christ and prove that the story could stand on its own feet without the supernatural claims, particularly the resurrection. Ended up writing. See how that hangs right on the edge of a ring? Is there anything you can do up there with knobs? You want to go try? Frank Morrison wrote, "Who Moved the Stone?" Probably one of the... He was an attorney who set out to disprove the resurrection, ended up writing the most convincing proof of the resurrection that I've read anywhere, in the book entitled, "Who Moved the Stone?" When you read this book, I'm a skeptic. This can't happen. They set out to disprove the elements of the story. But everywhere they turn, they find elements and or evidences that suck them more toward belief than disbelief. Now, the essence of the story is told by this Carlos. They, for example, many people have written on it, but nobody could find this guy Carlos. They found him. There's a picture of him in this book. And at the time the book was written, he was still living in central Mexico, ironically in the area of the craters that Dr. Jessup was investigating. He mentions a person in the book. He gives him a name. I think it's Randolph Reno. He had no way of knowing this guy, Allende. He mentions it in his letters, that the scientist he was speaking of had adopted an alias based upon a road sign Randolph so many miles and Reno so many miles near his residence. But the Carl Allen, who wrote the letters in this book to Dr. Jessup that started the story rolling, had no way of knowing that this scientist had a pseudonym or an alias. They trace him down, find him living in isolation like a hermit, full of fear, as though the analogy I feel is like those government witnesses that are given new names and settle somewhere. And he tells the story of the experiments. They search it out. They then find some other witnesses. But this is the story. I mean, you get done, you have to say, wait a minute, this couldn't happen. According to Carlos, the original letter writer, who claimed to be a witness on the merchant ship, Dr. Albert Einstein's unified field theory was in fact completed in 1925 to 27. But Dr. Einstein, by the way, the most devastating criticism of the Philadelphia experiment is based upon a critic who wrote and drew his arguments from a confession by Carlos Miguel Allende to a psychic group, a research group, not a funny group, in Arizona, where he went and said it was all a hoax. But he later recanted that, and the reason he did was because he was paranoid about further revelations of the subject and further pursuit of the subject and further research into the subject. So he wanted to put a stop to it, and admits he wanted to put a stop to it by trying, when he couldn't get through his letters to get it stopped originally, by trying to say it was all a hoax from the beginning. Subsequent facts destroyed the major argument against this being true. So now here are the facts. Here are the facts Carlos gave. Einstein's unified field theory was in fact completed in 1925-27, but Dr. Einstein withdrew it because he was allegedly horrified by the possible uses it might be put to by mankind not yet ready for it. This, according to Allende, could be confirmed by Dr. B. Russell. Now, that could be none other than Lord Bertrand Russell. So the first ingredient of his story to be researched is, what are the connections between Bertrand Russell and Einstein? And they check out. They were equal pacifists until the Nazi terror drove Einstein to his decision. Come on back where you were. Two, during World War II, second item, the concepts of the unified field theory were tested by the Navy with a view to any and every possible quick use of it, if feasible, in a very short time. Someone called Dr. Franklin Reno, a man Allende referred to as my friend, allegedly had something to do with producing results at this stage of the game. Back where you were. Turn the lights out. I want this to get scary again. This letter writer is strange, reticent, paranoid little man, scared to death by this experiment that nobody could find until these researchers found him, who wanted to stop any further discussion of it, who adopted Einstein's original position, deep six it, friend, bury it, had no way of knowing that Franklin Reno was not the name of the scientist, but rather a pseudonym that he had adopted because of a desire to conceal his identity And these researchers were able to ferret that out by going eventually and uncovering the fact he had taken his name from that road sign, as I said. A Franklin Reno had to be found. He was found in this book, his true name determined, and under some duress, he told his story, which is one of the strangest stories in this book. 3, the results thus produced that Franklin Reno helped in and is too cold. I'll get this house together if I keep working at it. The results thus produced were used to achieve, listen, this is why I don't believe it, complete invisibility of a ship, destroyer type, and all of its crew, while at sea, October 1943, by means of some sort of energy or force field which had been created around the ship. The men on the ship were apparently able to see one another vaguely, but all that could be seen by anyone outside the field was the clearly defined shape of the ship's hull in the water. The effects of this invisibility creating force field upon the men involved were, according to Allende, disastrous. Now, thanks to politics, we've got two cities joining us 30 minutes late. I'll be right back. Made you late. I am still on a Philadelphia experiment. Most unbelievable story. I don't believe it. And this is the summary of the stories that unfolded. Dr. Einstein's theory, unified field theory, worked out in the mid-20s, was suppressed by him because he didn't think man was ready to use it. The Hitler situation finally brought the tragic choice of letting his theories be developed, which produced the atomic and now nuclear threat to the world. But the unified field theory that everybody thought had been suppressed, a series of letters to Dr. Jessup indicated, and particularly under a certain Dr. Franklin Reno, the Navy had experimented with them with astounding results. The claim is, I don't believe this, the results thus produced were used to achieve, now I want to ask you a question. If we hadn't covered some of the things we've already covered, you realize how hard it would be to even listen to this? The results thus produced were used to achieve complete invisibility of a ship. Destroyer type. You know how hard it was for the ordinary world in Jesus' day to believe he rose? Now, we're all preset for these things. Let me keep going. The results thus produced were used to achieve complete invisibility of a ship. Destroyer type. And all of its crew while at sea, October 1943, by means of some sort of energy or force field which had been created around the ship. The men on the ship were apparently able to see one another vaguely, but all that could be seen by anyone outside of the field was the clearly defined shape of the ship's hull in the water. The effects of this invisibility-creating force field upon the men involved, according to Allende, were disastrous. The experiment, he says, was a complete success, but the men were complete failures. there was a special berth for the experimental ship at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. 5. A small item once appeared in the Philadelphia newspaper which verified the tale. This supposedly described the sailors' activities after their initial voyage when they raided a local bar, allegedly the Seaman's Lounge, and where they presumably were either still exhibiting the effects of the field or proceeded to discuss the experiment in such graphic terms that it terrified the waitresses. One is left to assume that the shore patrol was called and that some reporter picked up the story and wrote it up without quite believing it himself. 6. Allende himself claims to have observed at least portions of this experiment while at sea on board the Liberty ship SS Andrew Furuseth, a Matson Lines ship out of Norfolk, Virginia. This was sometime in October 1943. According to Allende, other men who were on deck at the time and witnessed the tests were Chief Mate Mousley, Richard Splicey Price, an 18 or 19-year-old sailor from Roanoke, Virginia, and a man named Connolly from New England, possibly Boston. 7. Rear Admiral Rawson Bennett, Navy Chief of Research, could supposedly verify that the experiment had in fact occurred. 8. The experimental ship also somehow mysteriously disappeared from its Philadelphia dock, showed up only minutes later in Norfolk. It then subsequently vanished only to appear again at its Philadelphia dock. Total elapsed time for this, matter of minutes. I don't believe it. Allende says he only heard about this phase of it and that this may have been as late as 1946 after the experiments were discontinued. Finally, in addition to his then current address, Allende supplies Jessup with following data about himself, his presumed merchant sailor Z number, the fact that he served on the SS Andrew Furuseth for some 6 months, on and on. Now, this book researches all this. They start out to confirm, number one, that the ship, the particular ship, Andrew Furuseth, that he was sailing on, in fact, was in the territory from ship logs and other such records at the dates that he says. They also are able to determine the particular ship that was the one docked in Philadelphia that's supposed to have disappeared. This is a picture of it from the National Archives. The USS Eldridge, DE-173. This is a picture of it on September 12, 1943. Second, they had to determine from this guy's mysterious letter, not only was the ship, the merchant ship that he was on in the area at the time, but it had to be in a place, well, second, this USS Eldridge had to be there at the time, and they had to be in a place where they could be sailing side by side, because Carl, the letter writer, claimed to have seen this invisible happening, transformation, as they were at sea, and he claims to have heard of the happening while it was docked, where it went from Philadelphia to Norfolk and back to Philadelphia. Got it? Now, you can do some research. I don't believe the story. But at least the story has more credibility. It's easy to blow the story if one of the ships is in Casablanca for all the months that he claims these happenings occurred. You can read the book. They researched it. And they checked. And they went to the records. Hold your hat. Got a ring. I need Joe back down here. Got a terrible ring in my mic. I think it's demon that's attacking us. Can I go slow on this? You know, I got to do a little heavy stuff as well as the interesting stuff. Here we go. If Allende's tale is true, if indeed the DE-173 did become invisible, and if the experiment was witnessed from the deck of the SS Andrew Furuseth, perhaps one of the best ways to try to learn more about it is to check out the available government archives on the ships involved. Were they in the area at the time? They put in a request for the logbooks of the two ships in question. I skipped a lot of preliminary research, where they went to the docks, where they were made. They traced them. They located the ships. Now they go to the official government archives so they can get logs and records so they can place these ships in the right places. The result of such a request was the surprising discovery that, one, the deck logs of the Eldridge for the period from date of commission, August 27, 1943 through December 1, 1943, were missing and therefore unavailable. And two, turn down a little, the logbooks of the Furuseth had been destroyed by executive order and thus no longer existed. Since the only period of time in the history of these two ships which is of any interest to this investigation is the time during which Allende served aboard the SS Furuseth, that is August 1343, through a January 30, 1944, they're wiped out from those records. Well, they didn't stop. They begin to search. What blew them apart was that the ship Eldridge was commissioned some 30 days after these events, so-called events, took place. Aha, the whole story's a lie. The ship was commissioned too late. But they had other records that they smoked out. For example, I think it was submarine records of some encounters that were shared with other ships. All the records indicated that the ships were going the wrong direction after they were commissioned. And to make a long story short, they picked up such things as a hurricane hit in the Bermuda Triangle area. And the USS Eldridge was docked in Bermuda for a day or two. But the ship that reports it was a bit disturbed because the signal flags were not out. And proper Navy procedure was not being followed as two ships meet and greet. And what they smoked out was the ship was built and not commissioned for 30 days later, and that with the necessity of ships, once they were commissioned, being assigned to various admirals, the minute they got them for war purposes, the chance of getting a ship for experiment was as remote as snowballs in hell. And what, in fact, they're able to smoke out and do it thoroughly and convincingly is that the ship, prior to commissioning, was in fact sent straight to Philadelphia and docked there. And for 30 days, they had the chance to do an experiment on their ship. And that's why it didn't show its signal flags, because en route to the dock in Philadelphia, the hurricane drove it into harbor at Bermuda for a few days, but it wasn't yet commissioned. So they proved conclusively the ship was in Philadelphia before it was commissioned. They also proved conclusively that it went out to sea and had contact with the Furuseth and was sailing in the right direction before the log dates are obliterated. Now that's one. They run down every lead. They confirm every confirmable part in terms of associated circumstantial evidence about the happening. There's a chapter in here that, for laymen, explains the unified field theory in a way that at least this preacher could understand. The possibility of isolating a gravitational field from electromagnetic field. The purposes that they were about in the experiment, which was to create this force field about 100 yards from each beam of the ship, which Allende said created a situation that if you were inside the field, the optical invisibility of the ship occurred, and the people in there were seen as hazy, and when they went into this field of invisibility, you had to feel around for them. And if you were outside the field, just against it, you could see the hazy figures within, though the ship was gone. As you got further away, total invisibility took over. I could explain it abstractly, still didn't believe it. I mean, I could understand the explanation abstractly, but still couldn't believe it. But then we get down to their continued research to find corroboration. You ready for this? An unusual report was unexpectedly received by Patrick Macy, an electronic construction specialist and researcher, while he was working on contract in Los Angeles in the summer of 1977. It'd be interesting if some of these people are listening to me. He and another contract worker, Macy remembers him only as Jim, were discussing UFOs and how much they thought the government was covering up. Quote, "I had an unusual experience during World War II while I was in the Navy," said Jim. "Not with UFOs, but something pretty mysterious. I was a guard for classified audiovisual material. And in late 1945, I was in a position, while on duty in Washington, to see part of a film viewed by a lot of Navy brass pertaining to an experiment done at sea. I remember only part of the film, as my security duties did not permit me to sit and look at it like the others. I didn't know what was going on in the film, since it was without commentary. I do remember that it concerned three ships. When they rolled the film, it showed two other ships feeding some sort of energy into the central ship. I thought it was sound waves, but I didn't know since I naturally wasn't in on the briefing. After a time, the central ship, a destroyer, disappeared slowly into a transparent fog until all that could be seen was an imprint of that ship in the water. Then, when the field, or whatever it was turned off, the ship reappeared slowly out of thin fog. Apparently, that was the end of the film. And I overheard some of the men in the room discussing it. Some thought that the field had been left on too long and that that had caused the problems that some of the crew members were having. Somebody mentioned an incident where one of the crewmen apparently disappeared while drinking in a bar. Somebody else commented that the crew were still not in their right minds and may never be. There were also some references to some of the crew having vanished permanently. At that point, the conversation was carried on outside of my hearing. In a secure safety deposit box, there exists a photocopy of a newspaper clipping, which was received from an anonymous source and which up to now has managed to survive all efforts to discredit its authenticity. Remember the reference by Carl of a newspaper article? Here it is. strange circumstances around Tavern Brawl. Several city police officers responding to a call to aid members of the Navy Shore Patrol in breaking up a tavern brawl near the U.S. Navy docks here last night got something of a surprise when they arrived on the scene to find the place empty of customers. According to a pair of very nervous waitresses, the Shore Patrol had arrived first and cleared the place out, but not before two of the sailors involved allegedly did a disappearing act. They just sort of vanished into thin air right there, reported one of the frightened hostesses. Or hostesses, and I ain't been drinking either. At that point, according to her account, the Shore Patrol proceeded to hustle everybody out of the place in short order. A subsequent chat with the local police precinct left no doubts as to the fact that some sort of general brawl had indeed occurred in the vicinity of the dockyards at about 11 o'clock last night. But neither confirmation nor denial of the stranger aspects of the story could be immediately obtained. One reported witness succinctly summed up the affair by dismissing it as nothing more than a lot of hooey from them Daffy Dames down there, who, he went on to say, were probably just looking for some free publicity. Damage to the tavern was estimated to be in the vicinity of $600. Victor Silverman. One unusually specific corroboration came from a seaman who claimed to have been on board during the dockside experiment at the Philadelphia Naval Yard, and who since the incident has suffered a number of premature heart attacks. Victor Silverman is his name. Am I boring you?
No.
Now living in Pennsylvania. This is a 4-hour. But no, you know, you're reading the book of Acts. Philip was on the Gaza Strip, and he was gone. And instantly, he's in Jerusalem. Oh, well, he went like a jet. Well, that's harder for me to believe than the other one. I mean, he was there, and then he was not there. And then he was somewhere else. Now, I've been telling you for quite some time. When it says in the Bible, Enoch walked and talked with God and was not, but God took him. Where? I believe God took him from Atlantis to the plains of Mesopotamia and the Nile River. And he built a pyramid with the help of watchers who could levitate stones. They've been trying to figure out for years how they got the stones from where they got them to the pyramid. If this is true, I know how they got them there. Now, if Einstein's brain could figure out the principle, oh, I know, if we don't understand it, it couldn't happen. You say, well, now, where'd the blood, where'd the bone, where'd the steel, where'd it go? What is all that stuff when you reduce it down to physics? I mean, where'd all those people go when the atom bomb dropped at Hiroshima? They were there, and then they were not. What are we worried about blowing the world up? We're going to pull atoms apart and get a chain reaction, the China syndrome. Now, that's as strange to a Hottentot in Africa as this is to us. It sort of suggests the Bible might be right that the essential self is not transferred through blood transfusion. How do you think we're going to... Let's go on. Victor Silverman, now living in Pennsylvania, and still mind, and I'm saying to you, if man through Einstein could figure out how to just dabble in this, don't you think demons know? They have the knowledge. They can levitate. Now, Christians for years have believed that demons and angels and some saints know how to conquer gravity. Oh, the angel of the Lord and chariots thereof, horsemen of the Lord and chariots thereof. And when Elijah goes up, here comes the mantle. How'd that happen? You say a rocket. Horse spit. Elisha said it was a chariot and horses. You say, you mean God's that primitive? My Lord, if he had taken him in a space, if he had taken him in a spaceship, it wouldn't even look miraculous to us today. The smarter we get and the more space travel we have, the more miraculous that chariot and horseman sailing off looks to me. I mean, there's real levitation. There ain't no horse in the world that can jump over the moon. Now, the most basic principle of biblical interpretation is your first meaning should be what it says. It's like these evangelicals saying those demons coming out of the pit, led by Abaddon, to bring hurt on the earth during the tribulation, the locust demons, or helicopters with flamethrowers attached. They're demons. Weird looking ones, too. Give you a heart attack to see them. I believe that Elijah was caught up in a chariot. Now think about that for a moment. Just think about it. Just think about it. Why don't you just think about it? Second Kings. First Kings. Second Kings. So many people read the Bible through, they don't pay attention to what it says. And it came to pass, 2 Kings 2:11, came to pass as they still went on and talked, that behold, there appeared, that's in italics added by the translators. Let's just read it without the translator's help. It came to pass as they still went on and talked, that behold, the chariot of fire and horses of fire. Parted them both asunder. I believe that's exactly what they were. Horses of fire and chariots of fire. If it was a spaceship, you'd say chariots. Horses of fire and chariots of fire parted them both asunder. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Storm clouds, a literal translation. Now we're leaving somebody, I guess. Don't know who, but I ain't stopping. I'm tired of being interrupted. Elijah takes off. Philip translated from Gaza Strip to Jerusalem. Now that power was available to Lucifer, to Christ, to the angels. I'm simply saying that if we are beginning to discover some of the principles of the universe until we can make them work in mysterious and strange ways. If this story is true, I don't have any trouble then with believing that demons know how to move doors and teleport them. I'm not going to give a scientific explanation to the source. I believe there are supernatural beings out there that know more about the workings of this universe than we do. I can't believe this story, But if I could believe this story, it'd make it easier to believe the other stories. And the other stories, if I can believe them, are less mystical and merely become a further extension of understanding on the way this universe is made up by those that know it. We're just beginning to discover it. Now, what about Victor Silverman? Am I boring you? Victor Silverman. Seaman. Now living in Pennsylvania. Not boring you. Victor Silverman, now living in Pennsylvania and still mindful of wartime security regulations and afraid of possible consequences, got in touch with the authors through a third party when he first heard about the publication of a book about the DE-173. He speaks from personal experience. Now, Carl saw it from afar. The guy with the movie saw some Navy brass years later looking at a movie about it. Victor Silverman says, I was on that ship at the time of the experiment. Let's listen to him. I mean, I'm from Missouri. At the outbreak of the war, Silverman enlisted in the Navy. He, along with about 40 others, were destined to become part of a special secret naval experiment. Well, now, if they rate ghost stories and lies and tall tales, this is the tallest and the biggest one, the worst lie of them all. You guys getting tired or something? I mean, they do that kind of camera work on CBS, NBC, and ABC, but never with us. Didn't I see a camera jerk down to find a book? Are you trying to duplicate the Philadelphia experiment? We just joined Reno and Los Angeles, and they don't know what I'm talking about. Now, the biggest lie that I have ever read is the Philadelphia experiment. William Moore and Charles Berlitz. I read it 3 times today. Still believe it's the biggest lie I ever heard, but I'm starting to believe it. I think I'm losing my mind. That's what they said. Everybody told this story. They certified them as loonies. Now, I haven't got time to catch up Reno and California, Los Angeles. I've already traced the way they set out disbelieving, but confirmed everything about it. And now they got Victor Silverman, now living in Pennsylvania and still mindful of wartime security regulations. I'm reading ghost stories, only this one ain't. I mean, I'm going right back to ghost stories in a minute. But this one brings us to the brink, based on Einstein's theory. Victor Silverman got in touch with the authors through a third party when he first heard about the publication of a book about the DE-173, the ship that supposedly disappeared. He speaks from personal experience. I was on that ship at the time of the experiment, he says. At the outbreak of World War II, Silverman enlisted in the Navy. He, along with 40 others, was destined to become part of a special secret Navy experimental project involving a destroyer escort vessel and a process which he could identify only as degaussing. On board the vessel, Silverman noted that there was enough radar equipment on the ship to fill a battleship, including an extra mast, which was rigged out like a Christmas tree with what appeared to be antenna-like structures. At one point, am I hearing strange sounds in here? Did you hear it? Like something on the roof? You guys hear that?
Yes, sir.
You want to go check the roof? No? You want to go alone or you want somebody to go with you? Let's take somebody with you. I don't think there's a ghost up there, but we have people that we have to look out for security reasons. I heard somebody up there. Did you or did you not? Was somebody pounding back here? Who's the guilty one? Go get Joe and bring him back. False alarm. Cut his legs off at the knee. At one point during the preparation for the experiment, Silverman remembers seeing a civilian on board and said to a shipmate, "That guy could use a haircut." To his amazement, he later discovered that the man had been Albert Einstein. Now, you're going to get the gestalt of this. I mean, these are coming from different sources, so many different places, but they all have little elements that represent what we call intrinsic indice of truth. This guy wouldn't know Einstein was there or involved. Silverman was given the rating of engineer first class, and according to his account, was one of three seamen who knew where the switches were that started the operation. He also related that a special series of electrical cables had been laid from a nearby powerhouse to the ship. When the order was given and the switches thrown, the resulting whine was almost unbearable. On another occasion, Silverman quite unexpectedly found himself in a deep fog, and his first thought was that he had somehow been blown off the ship. As he stood there, trying to comprehend what had happened, put yourself in the poor guy's place. He's walking on the ship, and then it ain't there. He thought he had been blown away. Get into this. I mean, you're sitting there as a skeptical, you can't even enjoy the poor fella that's having this happen to him. He's skeptical too. That's what I said. On another occasion, Silverman quite unexpectedly found himself in a deep fog. And his first thought was that he had somehow been blown off the ship. As he stood there, trying to find the ship. As he stood there, trying to comprehend what had happened. And looking for... looking for his ship. Looking for his ship. How'd you like Ernie? Put Ernie up there in the air. Now, just sort of get this feeling, Ernie. A green fog hits you, and you're just sitting there in the air trying to find your camera. Turn the lights out. That's fog. On another occasion, Silverman quite unexpectedly found himself in a deep fog. And his first thought was that he had somehow been blown off the ship. As he stood there, trying to comprehend what had happened and looking for his ship, he watched indistinct figures in motion, whom he could not identify as sailors and some other shapes that didn't seem to belong on the dock, if that's where I was. Suddenly, the deep fog flashed off. Leaving Silverman in a very confused state and wondering what in the world I was doing in Norfolk. You understand? He started out in Philadelphia. He said he had recognized the place as Norfolk because I'd been there before to the ship's other dock there. Then just as suddenly, the green fog returned. It lifted again, and Silverman found himself back at dockside in the Philadelphia Navy Yard. Now, don't you imagine Philip sort of had that same feeling? And he's down there talking to that Ethiopian eunuch, the edge of the desert. I don't know whether a fog hit him or not. But all of a sudden, he's surrounded by the smells of Jerusalem. For a long time afterwards, he related, I was left wondering whether or not I hadn't lost my mind for those few brief moments. I still don't know exactly what happened to me or to the other men who were there. Also very important is the fact that Silverman was able to recall the barroom brawl, which occurred shortly after this episode. He said, when the captain got word of this, he ordered everyone back aboard ship as fast as we could get there. We immediately put off from shore and stood out in the river all night until he got it straightened out. Tony Wells, now living in Southampton, England, writes about five British merchant seamen who in 1943 were waiting in Norfolk for berths on Liberty ships destined to go to England. One day, looking at the harbor from the dock, they were understandably amazed to see a sea level cloud suddenly form in the harbor and almost immediately dissipate, leaving a destroyer escort in full view, which stayed but a few minutes before it was covered by a cloud and vanished again. While the bemused seamen were wondering whether what they thought they had seen was real, the whole area was immediately cleared by naval security and shore patrol personnel. The seamen decided that perhaps in the best interest of getting back to England as soon as possible, it was best not to talk about whatever sort of projection or camouflage the Yanks were up to. So only recently corroborated their chance sightings of the elusive DE-173. A rather convincing indication that an experiment similar to the reputed Philadelphia experiment took place more or less as reported and was the subject of a secret memorandum read to certain officers and crews from the Secretary of Navy comes from Frederick Tracy, a Navy World War II veteran who served on three ships. One of them was the USS Antietam CV-36. Tracy had heard about the Philadelphia experiment from a shipmate, Fireman First Class D.J. Myers, in 1944. When their ship was in dry dock in Philadelphia. Myers pointed out a dock and said, see that dock over there? That's the dock a ship once disappeared at. Myers thereupon told Tracy the story. When he was finished, Tracy said, I don't believe you. To which Myers replied, I didn't think you would. The next year, however, well, I've read enough. Now, the government has a form letter if you write them. Form letter. Everybody gets the letter, like the ones the FCC write about me. Department of the Navy. In reply, refer to 01-22528/JVV/DH. 23 July 1976. Department of the Navy. Over the years, we have received innumerable queries about the so-called Philadelphia Experimenter Project and the alleged role of the Office of Naval Research, ONR, in it. The frequencies of these queries predictably intensifies each time the experiment is mentioned by the popular press, often in a science fiction book. Or Scott. The genesis of the Philadelphia experiment myth dates back to 1955 with the publication of the case for the UFOs by the late Dr. Morris K. Jessup, a scientist with a Ph.D. in astrophysics and a varied career background. Sometime after the publication of the book, Dr. Jessup received a letter by Carlos Miquel Allende, who who gave his address as RD number 1, box 223, New Kensington, Pennsylvania. In the letter, Linde commented on Dr. Jessup's book and gave details of an alleged secret naval experiment in Philadelphia in 1943. During the experiment, according to Linde, a ship was rendered invisible and teleported to and from Norfolk in a few minutes, with some terrible after effects for the crew members. Supposedly, this incredible feat was accomplished by applying Einstein's never-completed unified field theory. Linde claimed that he had witnessed the experiment from another ship and that the incident was reported in a Philadelphia newspaper. Neither the identity of Linde nor that of the newspaper has ever been established. Well, that's done in this book. In 1956, a copy of Jessup's book was mailed anonymously to Admiral Firth, the Chief of Naval Research. The pages of the book were interspersed with handwritten annotations and marginalia, apparently made by three different persons as they passed the book back and forth among them. The notations implied a knowledge of UFOs, their means of motion, and generally the culture and ethos of the beings occupying these UFOs. The book came to the attention of two officers then assigned to ONR who happened to have a personal interest in the subject. It was they who contacted Dr. Jessup and asked him to take a look at his book. By the wording and style of one of the writers of the notations, Dr. Jessup concluded that the writer was the same person who had written him about the Philadelphia experiment. It was also these two officers who personally had the book retyped and who arranged for the publication in typewritten form of 25 copies. The officers and their personal belongings have left ONR many years ago. We do not have even a file copy of the annotated book. And everybody believes that. Rise, flap your arms, and fly to heaven. The Office of Naval Research never conducted an official study of the manuscript. As for the Philadelphia experiment itself, ONR has never conducted any investigation on invisibility either in 1943 or any other time. ONR was established in 1946. Nice little rhetoric. I tell you, I never did any teaching in 1920. I wasn't born until 1929. The Navy did. ONR established in 1946. In view of present scientific knowledge, our scientists do not believe that such an experiment could be possible except in the realm of science fiction. A scientific discovery of such import, if it had in fact occurred, could hardly remain secret for such a long time. I hope this provides a satisfactory answer to your inquiry. Sincerely, Betty W. Shirley, Head, Research and Public Inquiries Section. All the other research might not be so convincing if it were not for the fact late in the evening on Tuesday, October 7th, 1975, Robert Suffern, a 27-year-old carpenter from rural Bracebridge, Ontario, received a call from his sister, who lives down the road, asking him to investigate a strange glow that seemed to be coming from a nearby barn. Suffern drove to the barn, took a quick look around, and not seeing anything out of the ordinary, was proceeding to his sister's house. When he was startled to see a darkened, saucer-shaped object about 12 to 14 feet in diameter squatting on the gravel road directly ahead of him. I was scared, he later recounted to a Toronto Sun reporter. It was right there in front of me with no lights and no signs of life. His car hadn't quite come to a full stop, he said, when the object went straight up in the air and out of sight. According to Safarin's story, he had no sooner managed to turn his car around and head for home when a strange... Now, what makes this significant is that was October. On December 12, 1975, after the Safarins were beginning to feel some semblance of order again, I skipped the rest of the story. Their farm was literally swamped for weeks by roving bands of curiosity seekers. Three men were delivered to their home in an Ontario provincial police cruiser. The appointment had been prearranged in November. These officials arrived in full uniform. bearing impressive credentials and representing themselves as the top brass from the Canadian Forces in Ottawa, the United States Air Force Pentagon, and from the Office of Naval Intelligence. Now, what's that bunch of brass coming to see this guy for? Now, the book's available in our bookstore. I don't know what it's worth. I don't know what this book costs. Oh, there it is. $2.95. That must be $3.50 would include postage, I guess. Yeah. If you want it, can't get it anywhere else. I don't want to read such a heavy scientific book all night long. I have some other things. Demon Possession by Nevius. I sent out to get it today. John L. Nevius. Experiences in the Shantung Province in China by a disbelieving missionary out of the conservative church who encountered demon possession, the likes of which he had never seen. Now, we've had a demonologist of the Catholic faith, a demonologist of the Pentecostal faith, a poltergeist experience in John Wesley's home. Now we're going to take a very conservative, respected missionary to China who gets blown away by an experience that will blow you away. I have other things to read. And I've got a lot of things that I want to read. But why am I reading that heavy Philadelphia experiment lie? There's just a lot of strange going on. Now, these people who experienced this, some of them who claimed to go invisible, saw alien creatures. Now, the shaman makes that trip through his tunnel. I just want to know if the Gestalt is coming home, that it's a bit premature to say these things couldn't happen, therefore they didn't happen. Something happened. And what I want to find out is, like the old country preacher says, now, Kneebuck had a rozzer. And what Wins is going to do today is find out what Brother Kneebuck did to that there rozzer. This spring, when I was at CT at Chuang in the district of Xiaquang, I was given the Christians there an account of the case of Mr. Kuo at Hingqia. My Chinese has a lot to be said for it. When an inquirer present said, we have a similar case here. It was that of a woman also named Kuo. She was 32 years of age and had suffered from this infliction 8 years. It happened that at the time of my visit, the woman was suffering more than usual. Her husband, in the hope that the demon would not disturb his wife in the house of a Christian, had brought her to the home of his brother-in-law, Mr. Sen, S-E-N, who had lately professed Christianity. On my arrival, they said to me, she is here, on the opposite side of the court, and they begged me to cast out the spirit, as they had tried every method they knew of without effect. Then, without waiting for my assent, they brought the woman into the room where I was. I said, I have no power to do anything of myself. We must ask God to help us. When we knelt in prayer, the woman was lying on the king, which is the earthen bed in North China, apparently unconscious. When the prayer was finished, she was sitting up, her eyes closed with a fluttering motion of the eyelids, her countenance like one weeping and the fingers of both hands tightly clenched. She would allow no one to straighten her closed fingers. I then, hardly expecting an answer as the woman had hitherto been speechless, said to the demon, have you no fear of God? Why do you come here to afflict this woman? To this I received instantly the following reply, Tien Fu Yeo Shu Fu Kwan An. Demons talk Chinese. I'll just read the translation. God and Christ will not interfere. I've been here 7 or 8 years and I claim this is my resting place. You can't get rid of me. Turn me down. Hope we get the demon out of these mics. She continued for some time uttering a succession of rhymes similar to the above, without the slightest pause. The purport of them being, I want a resting place and I will not leave this one. The utterances were so rapid that the verses given above was the only one I could remember perfectly. I can recall another line. You are man, I am Sheehan, one of the genii. After repeating these verses, evidently extemporized for the occasion, a person present dragged her back to her apartment, the demon not having been exorcised. Prayer didn't do it, my friend. Mr. Ling revisited the region in the month of August. I was attending service one Sunday in a village 2 miles from Si Kiao Chuang, and Mr. Sen from the latter village was present. Noticing Mr. Sen's hand, a paper parcel, I inquired what it contained. He told me it contained cinnabar. This was the medicine which was used for the purpose of expelling evil spirits there. Mr. Sen said he had procured it to administer to the possessed woman, Mrs. Kuo, who was suffering from her problem again very severely. I spoke then to the Christians present as follows. We're worshippers of the true God. We ought not to use the world's method for exorcising demons, but rather appeal to God only. The reason why we didn't succeed before was our want of faith. I went on to tell them how willing God is to answer prayer, told them they ought to go exercise. While this was transpiring at Wu Kiao Miao, whatever it is, the Christians at Si Kiao Chong were attempting to hold their customary Sunday evening service. But Mrs. Kuo, or the demon possessing her, was determined to prevent it. She raved wildly and, springing upon the table, threw the Bibles and hymn books on the floor. The wife of a younger Mr. Sen, who was a Christian, then became similarly affected, and the two women were raving together. They were heard saying to each other, those three men are coming here, and we've got as far as the stream. Someone asked, who's coming? The women replied with great emphasis, one of them is that man Lang. Family said, he'll not be here today, to which the demon replied, if he does not come here today, then I'm no Shin. They're now crossing the stream and will reach here when the sun is about so high, and she pointed to the west. And no one could have known the ordinary way they were coming. When we arrived at the village, a large company was assembled. After a time, I went into the north building where the two raving women were sitting together on the king. I addressed the demon possessing them as follows. Oh, you're not interested in this. I have one message. There's an awful lot of evidence out there if you want to look. Now, what can tie this together? I got some more things to finish, but I don't want to continue if I'm boring you. I used up so much time on that big lie of the Philadelphia experiment. I'm still mad about that.